Well, there was a regular passenger traffic, of course, in and out of Leeds City Station. Quite a lot of freight traffic going into Sturton, because Sturton at that time, it's now a Freightliner depot, but at that time it was still a freight yard. The Freightliner terminal didn't spring up out of nothing, it grew out of it being a goods sidings. And of course further down in Hunslet there was the big sidings at Barm Road there. So there's quite a bit of freight traffic in and out of Leeds, and as I say, the regular passenger traffic, the express trains during the summer, used to get a lot of specials in the summer. But the big thing, of course, was the coal traffic out of Woodlesford, out of Waterache Colliery, going into the power station at Skelton Grange. The signal box was there because you regulated traffic in both directions. So you could hold the goods trains and turn them out onto the main line, both directions. If there was a passenger train that was running late, you could take the freight train out of the equation by putting him on the slow line. The predominant reason it was there, I suppose, was for the coal traffic out of the colliery that ran into Skelton Grange. And you probably get sometimes as many as six or seven of these a day. Very, very busy. So the loaded trains would come out of Woodlesford Colliery loaded with coal, past Waterloo Box, across the main line on the crossover, and then across the viaduct is still there, I think, the concrete viaduct that led into Skelton Grange. What happened when it got into Skelton Grange? It was unloaded. I never went down to find out exactly how it was unloaded. I sometimes wish I had.
Was there a signal box at Skelton Grange as well then?
No.
On the railway? So
no.
Once it left you at Waterloo, it went onto the Central Electricity Generating Board tracks,
Skelton Grange.
And with the engine at the front of it?
Correct.
Right, all the way into Skelton
Grange. All the way into Skelton Grange.
Right, right.
Now, when it had unloaded, it'd probably be an hour's job. It didn't take very long to unload, really. You would get a call from the shunter to say the train was ready to go back into the colliery. And it followed exactly the same route back into the colliery as it took going in.
So tell me about the rules for that, for these trains that went back into Waterache Colliery, because that was a bit unusual, wasn't it, in terms of railway working?
I'd never come across it before or since. The train, having gone engine first into the power station, propelled the entire train. So the goods van was at the front coming back, and it came back across the main lines and went, travelled on the wrong line, as it were, all the way back into the colliery. And although you know what to expect, the first time you do it when you're by yourself, your heart's in your mouth, because it used to come out of the power station at a rate of knots. I mean, it wasn't sort of walking pace. So you double-check the points and the lock bars. And even so, when it comes flying out of the power station the wrong way, you're a bit apprehensive. But of course, after a while, it just became an everyday occurrence.
I suppose the drivers and the guard would have to be on the guard's van directing the driver in some way, wouldn't he? They knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing, yeah. But I mean, the guard, obviously the driver knew when he passed through Woodlesford Station that it was only a short while to go to get into the colliery yard. So he would slow down accordingly, and the guard would signal him accordingly.
So what do you remember about the passenger trains?
Well, the passenger trains, they were basically the trains out of Leeds going into Castleford and Wakefield Kirgit down that line. They seemed to be fairly well occupied, but I mean there was a regular service, of course, and they used to come off at Methley Junction, didn't they, from Castleford.
Can you remember the bell codes that you had at Waterloo?
Yeah, roughly. The 3-1 was the stopping passenger train, 4 was the express. Various codes after that was 113, I can remember, which was loco and guards van. 2-3, I think, was a light engine. The freight trains all had different codes depending on what they were. I remember they had the headlamp code as well. There was different headlamps, oil lamps on the front of the engine to signify what class of freight train it was.
Did you meet anybody else when you were working there, apart from the other two signalmen that you worked with?
Yeah, I was familiar with the plate layers. They used to come up and down, and used to come into the signal box, and I used to make them a cup of tea. A lot of signalmen, the old school, they wouldn't allow anybody in the signal box. They'd lock the door, but, I mean, I wasn't like that. If it was raining or anything like that, I'd ask them if they wanted a cup of tea and they'd come in the signal box. So I was quite familiar with the plate layers. The foreman was called Peter, And I remember Peter, and he was a big hearty chap with a red face. And the other one was Walter. I can't remember their surnames. Walter was my fog signalman. They was very close friends, the plate layers, actually. And they used to spend their evenings in the United Kingdom pub in Methley, if you know where the United Kingdom... It's not there now, is it? It's something else now. But they used to go in there. And Walter, he used to be my fog signalman because there was a fogging post right outside the signal box. Again, the signals. And he came in one night. I sent out for the fogmen one night, I remember. I was on nights. And Walter arrived. And he came in with some bottles of beer from Bentley's Brewery. He says, I've been in the brewery and I've fetched us some beer. I said, yeah, all right. Yeah. And it was Old Timothy. They used to make a brew called Old Timothy, Old Tim. And I had a drink of this in the signal, but I knew you'd had a drink if you had had a drink of Old Timothy. And I said, I've enough of that. I'll take it home. Thanks very much, Walter. And he'd obviously had a few drinks, and I was a bit up and down about whether to allow him. But I thought, well, if I say I've sent him home because he's drunk on duty, he's going to get the sack or into serious trouble. So I kept my eye on him and tolerated him. Anyway, after a while, he said, I'm going round the back of the signal box. He says, I'll get some potatoes out of the farmer's field for our supper, which he did. And he put them in the oven. And he was wandering around and he had these potatoes and he ate these potatoes and had some of this ale. And then he decided he wanted to be sick. So he went outside onto the veranda of the signal box and he was violently sick over the veranda and lost his false teeth. And so for the next hour, and I mean, down the side of the signal box there was the ashes from the fire and probably the contents of a million chemical toilets and he's poking around in the dark looking for his false teeth, which he eventually found, and the fog lifted and I sent him home.
So just explain to me what you mean by fog signalling for people who don't understand it. Why did you have to have a fog signal?
Every signal box had what were called a fog light. The paraffin lamp that lit the signals, the case that it fitted into at the back, there was a narrow slit, so it showed a white light to the rear. And these would be situated roughly the same distance from every signal box. And the rule was, if you couldn't see the back light on this because of the fog, you needed the fog signalman out. And the fog signalman came and they were stationed at the stop signals. And when the signal was on, at danger, they would put a detonator on the line to warn the train driver that the signal was at red. If he came over it, he cracked it because he couldn't see it because of the fog.
How did you actually get hold of the fog signalman then if they were...
You had to contact control at Leeds, the control office, and they had their own methods of getting them out. And then they arranged for you want to be at so-and-so, so-and-so. All these fog signalmen were on call-out. They were plate layers.
And did you have one for each direction of the line?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. But there was certainly... I think there was the only one. Some signalmen, they had signalmen at the distant signals, which is, of course, a cautionary signal. It's not a stop signal. To warn them that if they pass this on, if they couldn't see it, then the next signal's going to be at red.
Those men you're talking about, the plate layers, do you know what length of track that they looked after?
At Woodlesford, I think they certainly came up as far as Rothwell Haig. I don't think they went as far as Sturton. I could be wrong, but I think they went as far as Rothwell Haig and down towards Methley. What exactly length of track was, I don't know. At Ardsley, They went from Beeston all the way through to Lofthouse. They covered that stretch of track. I mean, we're not talking just a main line here. Of course, we're talking the sidings and everything else that they were responsible for.
And do you know how many of them there were? You remember two of them. Do you think there were more than two?
I think there were probably about a half dozen of them.
Right, and so there'd be a boss of them in some way, wouldn't
there? Yeah, this boss, the ganger, as I say, was this guy called Peter. Don't ask me what his surname is, right. I can't remember him.
Tell me more about the inside of Waterloo signal box, what it was like and what facilities you had.
Well, there was no running water. First, when I went there, there was no electric light, and I couldn't understand why there wasn't any electric light, why it should still be lit with paraffin lights, because there was electricity to the box, obviously, to power the block instruments. And I wrote to the personnel officer in Leeds, pointing this out and asking if he'd consider putting electric lighting in the box. There was some delay because there was some talk about that they would need to run a cable across the farmer's field and he wouldn't give them permission. But eventually, by one means or another, electric light was installed. But there was no running water. The heat was by way of the old-fashioned barrel stove, cast-iron stove. And actually, in the cold weather, I remember when you went off on Sunday morning and you was coming back on at Sunday night, we used to riddle the thing out until there was just a small depth of red coke at the bottom, or coal, and then put on top of that a layer of ash, and then a layer of coke, and a layer of ash, and a layer of coke, all the way up to the top. So that when you come on at Sunday night, it kept the box warm all day, and you just riddled the thing out and you was off again.
Where did you get your coal from?
There was a coal bunker outside the signal box, and periodically, when you run out of coal, you would get to work Sunday, because there would be a train would come up with a wagon load of coal, and you shovel the wagon load of coal out into the bunker.
All right, so it stopped on the main line outside.
On the main line, yeah. Yeah.
Right. And what about water? Where did your water actually come from?
Woodlesford Station. During the day, a freight train would bring it up. Somebody would fill it up. One of the porters on the platform would fill this up, and he would bring it up for you, and then he'd send it back the same way.
What did it come in?
Big sort of milk churns. And the toilet was by way of a chemical toilet, of course, because there was no flush toilet there. It was a chemical toilet.
What about the sort of decoration inside the box? What was that like?
Well, it was very sparse. There was some lockers made out of wood that doubled up as a seat in one corner. And the clock, of course, and a big high desk that held the train register book and a seat where you could sit on to make entries into the train register book. But that was it, basically.
Tell me about the train register book. What did you have to do with that?
All the train movements had to be recorded. You began, the first entry was by a description of the train or the bell code, so it would start if it was engine and brake van. Well, let's say light engines, 2, 3 it was. So it's ding, 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 so you know it's a light engine coming. So you're into the bell code. The time that you accepted it, the time that you passed it on, the next bell code you would receive would be the train entering section. So you had to enter the time of the train entering section and the train passed out of your section. The train passing into the next section, and the time when the train passed out of the next section.
How did you know where the train was?
In each of the signal boxes, there's a big diagram. And on the diagram, which is basically, it's just a plan that shows you all the railway lines where they are. And there was what's called train circuits, little lights that lit up to show you the progress of the train. So you could see all this was locked into the levers. And by a system of movements, they were all fail-safe systems. So, for instance, if your section was occupied, you couldn't physically operate a signal that allowed another train into the section. So if it failed for some reason, if the light stayed on when it should have gone out, then you couldn't operate the signals, and you accordingly you had to follow regulations and send the next train past at caution after you'd stopped him at the signal box and told him what had happened. And then, of course, you had to get the signal fitters out to rectify the fault.
And you communicated with the boxes on either side, which were Woodlesford going south and Rothwell Hague going north. Mm. You communicated with these bell codes that you're talking about.
That's right, yeah, yeah. But of course, you had a telephone as well to speak to them. So you had it both ways. But basically, if you accepted a train, for instance, that was passing over the facing points, the first thing that you had to do when you'd accepted the train is to pull the points. Then you have to pull the lock bar to lock the points in place.
Now, what's that? Why do you have to do two levers?
Well, because the facing points means, of course, it's facing the direction the train's coming onto them, so they can be derailed. So the lock bar is a safety device to ensure that the points are fully fitted up and locked. All these old films that you see about the crook running across the railway line and getting his foot caught in the points, I mean, it's a lot of nonsense. Unless the points are fitted up exactly flush, you can't operate the lock bar. And unless you operate the lock bar, you can't operate the signal. So you've got three safety devices there. You've got the points must be fitted up flush, the lock bar must be fitted up flush before you can pull the signal. And even then, you can't operate any of them if one of the track circuits shows that the line's occupied.
Say you had a train that was coming from Leeds on the up slow line, a goods train.
Yeah.
Would there be different signals for that point coming onto the up main line? Would there be different locking bars depending on whether the train was originating on the slow or the fast?
Yeah, I mean, on there was no lock bar for the main line as such if the train was going straight through, because you weren't operating any points. The presumption was the main line is fixed. It's only when you come to move trains off the main line onto the slow line, for instance, that you're operating points that have to have a lock bar. So you'd have a lock bar, for instance, if you turned a train off the main line at Waterloo going into Leeds. If you turn him onto the slow line, then you would operate the points, lock bar, signal.
Where were the signals in relation to the box? Were they individual signals, or was there a gantry or anything?
There was a gantry. Basically, I mean, they put the signals down for the different lines. So a train driver approaching Waterloo box would know which the signal was for the main line. They would be on the same gantry, but there would be a signal for the slow line. So if it was, for instance, a freight train was coming along, he could tell by the different signals that he was going to put him onto the slow line.
It must have been quite a thing then for an 18-year-old and a 19-year-old, as you were, to be in such a responsible position.
Yeah, it was. Curiously enough, I had a visit. I'd been there maybe a month, 6 weeks, and I had a visit one night from Mr. Swaby, the station master, who was a nice man, Mr. Swaby. I like Mr. Swaby. And he came in the signal box and he said, there's a problem with you. And I said, well, what do you mean, Mr. Swaby? He says, you shouldn't be here because you're too young. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you're not allowed to be a signalman until you're 18 and a half. And he says, you're not 18 and a half. You're only just 18. But he said, it's been the subject of quite a bit of correspondence with the staff office in Leeds. And he said, because you passed your signalling exams before you went to signalling school, and then you passed out in extra good time at the signalling school, it would cause too many problems to try and reverse the process, because you'd have to go back to Ardsley and display somebody at Ardsley who'd display somebody else. So he said, because you're only 2 or 3 months off being 18 and a half, we're going to turn a blind eye and take a bit of a risk. So there you are.
So in other words, he was saying he trusted you.
Yeah, yeah. So in the great scheme of things, if anybody ever talks to you about young signalmen, you can say, well, I've probably been speaking to one of the youngest signalmen ever, because he shouldn't have been there. He wasn't old enough.
So do you think then the reason that they let you carry on was that other signalmen didn't want to work at Waterloo?
No, well, I don't know. There was always a shortage of signalmen. Times have passed now. I mean, going back to the 1960s, there must have been something like 1920 signal boxes between Leeds and Wakefield Westgate going through Ardsley. There aren't any there now. But in those days, there was always vacancies for signalmen. In those days, everything was based on seniority. If a vacancy for a signalman came up at Woodlesford Station, then there may be a half dozen applicants. There may be no applicants. If there were a half dozen applicants, then the man with the seniority would be the one who'd get the job.
Whose responsibility was it to keep the box clean and tidy?
It was our responsibility. It was the signalman's responsibility. All signal box floors, if I remember rightly, were covered with the same brown lino. And you'd a mop and bucket and you cleaned the thing out as you thought fit. But, I mean, there was a veranda going round the signal box, so it was your job to keep the windows clean as well and polish the levers. You know, we used to polish the tops of the levers. And the brass instruments, of course. You had to be careful, because when you were operating the block instrument, if you had your hand on the lever at the same time, you get a shock. And you learn very quickly not to do it, but every now and again when you have a lapse of memory, if you're not careful, if your right hand's in contact with the block instrument, the brass part, of course it's electrical, you're all right, but if you touch the lever at the same time, you get a shock, and it gives you a bang.
What did you do then when there weren't many trains?
You weren't allowed to have a radio, but of course most signalmen did have a radio. The transistor radios were out by this time, so most of us had a small transistor radio. But I mean, there was no such thing as portable televisions or anything like that, so it was either a newspaper or a book, or you could listen to the radio.
And what on the night shift did you get many trains?
Yeah, but there tended to be long gaps when you didn't. Usually between about midnight and 2 o'clock, it was very quiet. That was the graveyard part of the shift, I suppose. But as the night wore on, you got things like mail trains and etc. heading into Leeds. So it got quite busy as it got towards 6 o'clock in the morning.
Were there any accidents in your area when you were there?
I had a suicide I remember when I was on nights one night, this freight train came down and it stopped outside the signal box, and the fireman got out and he said, "I think we've hit somebody somewhere around about Rothwell Hague." He said, "We've certainly struck something. I think it was a man." Well, at that, he proceeded on his way, and I got hold of the control and I told him, "Well, the regulation said you had to get someone out to examine the line. And the rule book, as I remember rightly, said it had to be a competent person. But it didn't say who was competent." And the controller in Leeds said, "Well, I think you should close the box and you should go down and examine the line. Sorry, 18 years old in the middle of the night. There's no way I'm going to go down there looking for bodies. Thank you very much." And so they got an engine, a light engine, out of Sturton Loco, because there was a loco at Sturton. And this train came out of Sturton, driver and fireman. And he came down and he confirmed that there was a body up on the line that was headless. I assume that this guy had put his head on the line, poor devil. And the next stage then is to get the railway police on the job. And the railway police came and moved the body. But by this time, it moved on to about 6 o'clock in the morning, I think, and my mate had come on duty, so it was left to him to sort out the sort of nitty-gritty.
And did you ever find out what the story was, who the person was?
No, I didn't, no. But I understand, somebody told me afterwards that they'd been there, and the police, they just come out and they mark the position of the body in chalk, and then they arrange for it to be taken away, and that's it.
Did you ever work much with Bill Tiffany? What kind of a character was he?
Curmudgeonly. That's the best way to... He didn't get on with a lot of people, didn't Bill? He certainly didn't get on with David. They were at daggers drawn, those two. But he was the kind of a man... If I was on days and he was on afternoons and he was due to take me off at 2 o'clock, you would see him at 5 to 2. The other way around, when you're on the afternoon shift, you might get out of bed at home 8 o'clock or whatever it happens to be. But the rest of the time, you're looking at your watch because you know you're going to work. So when it was me, if it got to 1 o'clock, if I was fed up, I just used to go to work and take them off at 1:30 or whatever it was. But Bill was always 5 to 2. He was one of those characters, yeah.
He was a man of routine, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he was quite taciturn. He didn't speak very much to people.
That's right, yeah. They didn't have much to say. And perhaps people mistook that for being a bit of a curmudgeon. But no, he didn't have a lot to say. And I knew he lived in Woodlesford, but I don't know whereabouts in Woodlesford he lived. But he never spoke about his family or his wife or anything like that. So when you had a conversation with him, it was a brief 5 minutes, because you told them when you changed shift which trains were in section, anything unusual that had happened, and then you signed off in the train register book and you went home. So I never stopped to sort of have a long conversation with him.
And did you know any of the other Woodlesford staff, the porters or the other signalmen?
The signalman on my shift was called Dave. Ken Free, was it, at Methley? He was the same shift as me.
And did you talk to the other signalmen along the line in a social way? Did you have conversations about things other than railway things on the telephone?
Oh, yeah. I think Ken, who was at Methley, he'd a lodger who was a signalman at Methley Junction, a Geordie lad, I think. So I knew that, and yeah, we used to talk about various things, same as any men do together, football and that kind of thing.
Was that allowed that you could do that?
Or... Yeah, well, I mean, there was no regulation that said that you couldn't talk socially to someone on the telephone. I mean, it was an open line, so there were two or three of you could speak together. Do you know what I mean? You could speak, there could be four or five people on the line. But as long as you weren't stopping the efficiency of the railway working, no, there was never any problem with it.
And people could listen in to you from quite a long way away, couldn't they?
I would have thought so, yeah. Some signal boxes, I can't remember what it was at Waterloo, but some signal boxes had a sort of a telephone junction, if you like. So there were various switches you could operate to speak to people on different sections of the branch. I can't remember what it was at Woodlesford at Waterloo, but I do remember when I worked at Ardsley, there were certain switches where you could, if you knew the number, you could ring someone on a different section of track altogether.
And how often would you at Waterloo have to talk to the head office, so to speak, the control office?
Well, you speak to them quite often, but I mean, you were speaking to a voice, if you know what I mean, when you're speaking to the controller. You weren't aware of what the name was. It was just, hello, control, so-and-so, so-and-so.
And what were those so-and-sos if you were at Waterloo? What did you have to tell control? Did you have to tell them every time a train came out of Skelton Grange, for instance?
No, I don't think so. You only spoke to control if you was asking it, if a train was late, for instance. Or the control would ring you and tell you something. It would say, this is the control, such and such a passenger train's running late. Will you try and hold the freight train back that's coming up at so-and-so, so-and-so? They wouldn't tell you to do it because it was always your decision. But they would ask you, and various things like if you wanted the fog signalman out, or if there was a problem, or obviously if there was something like a derailment or an accident. Control was there to control the train movements, but they can't control the train movements unless they know where all the trains are. So, it would depend. For instance, I remember on one occasion having an argument with control because I'd let a freight train out in front of a passenger train. Now, depending on what the class of freight train is, let's say it was a class 5, they would be given a time interval. So they would be given, say, 20 minutes to get to Normington, for argument's sake. Now, the option of getting from Woodlesford to Normington in 20 minutes, that's the responsibility of the driver. It's not the responsibility of the signalman. So if there's 25 minutes to go before a passenger train's due, perfectly justified in turning the freight train out in front of it. And so, of course, the control would ring up and say, why have you turned this freight train out? You've held up the passenger train. Well, I haven't held up the passenger train at all. I let him out at such and such a time. He's got plenty of time to get there. If he hasn't got there, you don't need to take up the driver. This is the sort of thing that went off. And there were one or two signalmen, I think, just to deliberately wind them up in control.
Because you were, in a way, your own boss in the signal box, weren't you?
That was one of the attractions of being a signalman. I mean, I know a lot since then. A lot of people that have gone to be signalmen and said, oh, I can't do with it. It's lonely, you never see anybody and all the rest of it. But for people like myself, it was an attraction because you're your own boss, you make your own decisions. There's nobody leaning over your shoulder every 2 minutes telling you what to do.